Well, good morning, everyone. I'd like to start by acknowledging the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and all the First Nations of Australia, their elders, customs, traditions, and any First Nations people in the audience today. I'd also like to thank CFI Societies Australia for the opportunity to speak this morning. So, December this year marks the 40th anniversary of the decision to float the Australian dollar and remove restrictions on capital flows. This reform has been one of the greatest success stories of Australian macroeconomic policy and is a key pillar of our monetary policy framework. A floating exchange rate buffers the economy from external shocks and allows monetary policy to focus on the goal of domestic price stability. When the dollar was floated in 1983, capital controls were removed because they weren't needed any longer to maintain the fixed exchange rate. Liberalising capital flows has had significant benefits. It allows investment in Australia's productive capacity to be unconstrained by the availability of domestic savings, and it enables Australian households and businesses to diversify their portfolios and benefit from attractive opportunities overseas. Now, Australia is a country with a lot of profitable investment opportunities. So for almost all of our history, since colonisation, foreigners have invested more in Australia than Australians have invested overseas. This was true even when the exchange rate was fixed and capital flows were restricted. The result has been an accumulation of foreign debt and foreign ownership of Australian assets. When restrictions on capital flows were lifted in 1983, Australia's net foreign liabilities increased noticeably. They then continued to trend higher to reach a peak of 63% of GDP in 2016. Now, history has shown that persistent capital inflows and a build-up of foreign debt can be a source of vulnerability to sudden stops that cause a collapse in external borrowing and aggregate demand. So it's understandable that Australia's external debt has regularly been at the forefront of the national economic conversation. Even though a floating exchange rate greatly reduces the likelihood of sudden stops. At no time was this more apparent than in 1986 when Paul Keating famously warned that Australia risked becoming a banana republic. Concerns since the dollar has been floated have related to whether national savings is perhaps too low or whether foreign currency borrowing creates risks for financial stability. But in recent years, something very remarkable has happened. Australia's net foreign liabilities have fallen sharply to their lowest level as a share of GDP since the 1980s. And this has largely flown under the radar, given the significant challenges posed by the COVID pandemic and its aftermath. So in my remarks today, I'll discuss why Australia's net foreign liabilities have declined and what its economic significance might be. In particular, I'll provide two main reasons why net foreign liabilities have declined. One is that national saving has been higher than national investment, resulting in capital outflows and current account surpluses for the first time since the 1970s. The other is that valuation effects associated with higher interest rates have reduced the value of the existing stock of external debt, while higher US equity prices and a depreciation of the exchange rate have increased the value of external assets in Australian dollar terms. I'll also observe that a net foreign liability or asset position is not necessarily good or bad. External debt doesn't create significant vulnerability for Australia because most of Australia's external debt is issued in Australian dollars and the debt that isn't is very well hedged. Turning to the reasons why Australia has become a net exporter of capital. So national savings and investment refers to the combined saving and investment of all households, businesses and government in Australia. When national investment is higher than national saving, a country imports capital and records current account deficits. Australia has historically been an importer of capital, not because national saving has been low in comparison to other advanced economies, but because investment has been high. Foreign capital has been attracted by an abundance of investment opportunities that offer relatively high rates of return. This was especially apparent during the mining investment boom that started in the early 2000s, when high commodity prices raised expected rates of return relative to investment. Then as the mining boom transitioned from the investment phase to the production and export phase, national income and saving were boosted by higher export volumes, so there was a commensurate decline in investment as a share of national income. Meanwhile, Australia's superannuation guarantee has supported a trend increase in household saving over many years. Mandatory superannuation contribution rates have increased gradually from an initial rate of 3% in the early 1990s to the current rate of 11% in June 2023. The contribution rate is scheduled to increase further to 12% in 2025. National saving was then boosted further during the pandemic when a sharp increase in household and corporate saving wasn't completely offset by the government's substantial fiscal stimulus. Since then, household saving has declined to be a bit below pre-pandemic levels, while government saving has increased as fiscal consolidation has taken place. But national saving remains at a high level, both in historical terms and in comparison to other advanced economies. The outcome of these developments is that national saving has been higher than national investment since 2019. And in a departure from history, Australia has recorded current account surpluses and net capital outflows for the first time in over 40 years. Now, here I think it's worth saying that net capital outflows don't necessarily imply that Australia no longer offers an abundance of profitable investment opportunities. The share of investment in GDP is lower than it was during the mining boom and in the past, but it's similar to other advanced economies. This graph shows the composition of capital flows. During the mining boom, a large share of investment was financed with foreign direct investment, or FDI. And they're the yellow bars in this graph. Part of this FDI was in the form of reinvested earnings by mining companies during a period where their profitability was high. FDI then declined as the mining boom shifted from the investment phase to the production and export phase, and a greater share of mining profits are now paid out as dividends. Another notable trend over recent years is the increase in net portfolio outflows, and they're shown in the blue bars. These portfolio flows largely relate to Australian superannuation funds investing more overseas. It's worth observing here that care does need to be taken when interpreting net capital inflows in any given year. Last year, you'll see with the very big lines there, or the very big bars, that Australia recorded the largest net FDI outflow in any year since at least the 1960s. But this wasn't explained by a genuine withdrawal of investment by foreigners. Capital flows in 2022 were affected by a range of highly publicised mergers and acquisitions, and if you just look at gross inflows of FDI into Australia, they actually increased in 2022, and FDI was one of the top, and Australia was one of the top destinations for FDI globally. Looking now at the current account. So the current account is the counterpart to the capital and financial account. It records the net flows of payments across borders that relate to trade, which is the orange line on the graph, and net income on foreign assets and payments on liabilities, which is shown in the blue line on the lower panel of the graph. In 2019, the current account turned from deficit to surplus because the trade surplus became larger than the net income deficit. High commodity prices and the mining sector's greater productive capacity have supported exports and so income over this period. Services, including education and tourism, account for a smaller share of trade but have also supported net exports of late, with services exports recovering by more than services imports since borders reopened after the pandemic. Australia's persistent net income deficit reflects our net foreign liability position. It also reflects that yields on Australia's external liabilities have been higher than yields on our external assets for most of our history, and you can see that in the left-hand panel of this graph. But looking at the middle panel now, the net income deficit has widened since 2019 because of higher dividend payments on foreign-owned equity. This mostly relates to the increased profitability of foreign-owned mining companies given recent high commodity prices. So mining companies are receiving more revenue from exports, which shows up as a trade surplus, but a portion of this is being returned to foreign investors in dividend payments, which is recorded as a net income deficit. So these are slightly offsetting factors on the overall balance of the current account. The pandemic caused significant volatility in equity payments to non-residents, just to explain what the big movements in that line there are. There was a sharp fall when Australian companies froze dividend payments in the early stages of the pandemic, and a rebound when dividend payments later caught up to corporate profits as economic conditions turned out to be better than expected. The panel on the right-hand side shows the net cost of servicing Australia's net external debt liabilities. These have also increased over the past 2 years of interest rate, as interest rates have risen globally and in Australia. So that's what's been going on with the current account. Turning now to the composition of net foreign liabilities. On the liability side, there's been a substantial decline in long-term debt as a percent of GDP since 2020. That's the blue line on the graph. That said, long-term debt still accounts for the bulk of our external debt. On the asset side, net holdings of foreign equity have been increasing for many years. So turning first to the decline in long-term debt. So banks account for a large share of the decline in long-term external debt since early 2020. In the early stages of the pandemic, there was a decline in the stock of banks' offshore debt, reflecting, in part, access to low-cost domestic funding, including through the Reserve Bank's Term Funding Facility, as well as lower credit growth. The Term Funding Facility closed to new drawings in June 2021, and debt issuance by Australian banks has increased since then. The Reserve Bank's bond purchases to address market dysfunction, support the yield target, and as part of the bond purchase program may also have contributed to a decline in the share of government debt held by foreigners, though the effect of this on the level of external government debt was offset by the substantial fiscal stimulus. More recently, fiscal consolidation has been taking place. Now, here it's worth observing that the Reserve Bank's pandemic response affected the composition of net external liabilities or net foreign debt, but it didn't necessarily cause liabilities to decline. As I've already discussed, net capital outflows occurred because national saving was higher than national investment. Since early last year, rising interest rates have caused bond prices to decline, and this has contributed to a decline in the valuations of long-term debt liabilities and net foreign liabilities overall. So that's the second part of it, the valuation effect. Longer-term bond prices are more sensitive to interest rate changes than shorter-term bond prices because of their higher average duration. Meanwhile, the exchange rate has had very little impact on the value of Australia's net long-term debt. As I'll discuss shortly, most of Australia's external debt is denominated in Australian dollars. It's also worth observing that high commodity prices and inflation have increased nominal GDP relative to the stock of existing liabilities. In other words, some of the debt has been deflated away. Looking at equities now. So another key driver of the decline in Australia's net foreign liability position has been the increase in Australia's net holdings of foreign equities. Some of this increase reflects the accumulation of foreign equities by superannuation funds, which have invested a greater share of funds offshore. Valuation effects have also lifted the value of foreign equity assets in Australian dollar terms in recent years. Indeed, the price of US equities, which make up around half of Australia's portfolio equity assets, have increased by over 150% in the last decade. This compares to a 30% increase in Australian equity prices over the same period. The depreciation of the exchange rate in recent years has further boosted the value of foreign equity assets in Australian dollar terms. And this leads me to another important point about Australia's experience with a floating exchange rate. The health of financial institutions and other corporations has been largely unaffected by exchange rate fluctuations. As I already mentioned, most of Australia's debt is denominated in Australian dollars, and the debt that is not issued in Australian dollars is very well hedged through both natural and financial hedges. The dangers of unhedged FX borrowing are very well known. Australians learned a very important early lesson about this in the years after the float, when in the mid-1980s, some borrowers tried to avoid paying much higher Australian interest rates by borrowing in Swiss francs. But when the Australian dollar later depreciated against the Swiss franc, borrowers found themselves unprepared for the sharp rise in debt servicing costs. While the overall quantum of borrowing was small enough that it did not cause systemic problems, it did receive a lot of publicity. And it's one of the reasons in our national memory that people are worried about foreign debt. Now, there could still be vulnerabilities to exchange rate fluctuations. Sorry, I've missed a page here. Now, if a country has significant unhedged FX borrowing, there's a risk that the so-called... If a country has significant unhedged FX borrowings, there's the risk that the so-called financial channel of the exchange rate can offset the traditional trade channel. Under the trade channel, an exchange rate depreciation increases foreign demand for exports and reduces domestic demand for imports, which stimulates the economy all else equal. But if borrowers have more unhedged FX debt than assets, an exchange rate depreciation weakens their balance sheet. This tightens domestic financial conditions and dampens investment and economic activity. If a currency depreciation increases the value of unhedged FX debt to the point where there are concerns about borrowers' ability to service and repay it, there can be sudden stops in capital flows as investors try to withdraw, which makes the situation worse. Overall, unhedged FX borrowing can significantly diminish a floating exchange rate's ability to act as a shock absorber. Now, the financial channel of the exchange rate is not likely to be important for Australia because Australia as a whole has a net FX asset position, despite our overall net liability position. In this graph, FX assets and liabilities are shown in blue, while Australian dollar assets are shown in orange. And what you can see is that our external liabilities are mostly dominated in Australian dollars, why our foreign currency, our foreign assets are mostly denominated in foreign currencies. In fact, all Australian government debt is issued in Australian dollars. Now, there could still be vulnerabilities to exchange rate depreciations if some sectors of the economy have unhedged FX exposures. But as you can see from this graph, this does not appear to be the case. While individual firms may occasionally run into trouble if they don't manage their currency risk, all sectors of the economy have net FX asset positions once hedging is taken into account. Importantly, this includes banks, which account for the majority of gross FX liabilities. Now, the other financial institutions in this graph mostly reflect superannuation funds. Superannuation funds have significant holdings of unhedged FX assets, and the Australian dollar value of these assets will be affected by exchange rate fluctuations. However, this isn't likely to create financial stability risks. One reason is that superannuation funds in Australia are defined contribution schemes. And as I've already described, equities account for a significant share of superannuation funds' foreign assets. In periods of crisis and risk aversion in global markets, the Australian dollar typically depreciates, and that at least partly offsets decline in risk asset prices, like foreign equities, in Australian dollar terms. So it acts as a shock-absorbing mechanism in a way. Given Australian superannuation funds have substantial holdings of unhedged FX assets, it's interesting to ask if there might be a financial channel of the exchange rate that actually works in the same direction as the trade channel or enhances that channel. That could occur if households responded to greater superannuation wealth by increasing their consumption. But this doesn't seem very likely. The Reserve Bank research has found very little evidence that stock market wealth has a significant effect on household spending in Australia, especially when it's indirectly held through superannuation. Overall, Australia's freely floating exchange rate does not create significant financial stability risk because of the net FX asset position that is enhanced by hedging. As a result, the exchange rate's ability to act as an effective shock absorber is not impeded by Australia's net foreign liability position, which is one of the concerns that people have had over the years. It's also worth observing that deep and liquid hedging markets did not develop overnight. Development was spurred in part by the increase in Australian dollar volatility after the float, as well as the need to hedge interest rate and foreign exchange risks associated with increased borrowing from offshore. For Australia, the floating of the dollar and the removal of restrictions on capital flows catalysed the development of financial markets, and in doing so, the risk of sudden stops has all but been eliminated. So to conclude, the substantial decline in the value of Australia's net foreign liabilities as a share of GDP reflects two main factors. The first is a high rate of national saving and the shift to current account surpluses since 2019. And the second is that rising interest rates have reduced the value of existing external debt, while rising global equity prices and a depreciation of the exchange rate have supported the value of external equity assets in Australian dollar terms. So it's both flows and valuations at play. National income and saving have been supported by large trade surpluses generated by high commodity prices and export volumes. Meanwhile, the superannuation guarantee has contributed to a trend increase in saving over many years, and higher saving during the pandemics also contributed. So overall, Australia's net foreign liability position is not a cause for concern. Australia benefits from strong institutional arrangements, the ability to issue debt in Australian dollars, and deep and liquid foreign exchange hedging markets that Australia developed after the float. Most external debt is longer term, and it's issued in Australian dollar terms, and the debt that is not issued in Australian dollar terms is very well hedged. Together, these features have enabled Australia to significantly benefit from the decision 40 years ago in December to float the exchange rate and liberalise capital questions. I'll now be pleased to take your questions. Thank you.
I think we'll also grab the seat furthest down. Well, Penny, thank you so much. That was quite fascinating. We have a few questions coming in that I've been monitoring. I think the first one I'll take is, you mentioned that the exchange rate is continuing to act as a shock absorber, but even though the RBA has been raising interest rates, the exchange rate has depreciated. What's going on?
Yeah, well, it's a good question, and it's an important one. So all else equal, a rise in domestic interest rates in Australia relative to interest rates offshore increases the demand for Australian dollar assets, or Australian assets, and it increases the value of the Australian dollar. But of course, you know, we're not in an all else equal world. Other central banks are raising rates, and for the same reasons, to combat high inflation. And so despite raising interest rates since May 2022, the Australian dollar's depreciated by 3% in trade-weighted terms, and about 9% against the US dollar, or maybe it's a bit closer to 10 actually. There's been other global developments in the not all else equal front. There have been concerns about growth in China and developments there. Australia is, of course, a major exporter of commodities, and China is our largest trading partner. Raising interest rates has helped to support the currency. The dollar would have been much lower than otherwise if we hadn't done that. So it is still working, I would say. The other point I would make is that which exchange rate you use actually really matters. If you're talking about what's the effect, say, on imported inflation, it's the trade weighted index, and as I mentioned, that has depreciated, but only about 3%. Since May 2022, whereas it's really the US dollar where there's been the bigger depreciation, and that has mostly reflected US dollar strength given what's been going on there, and that actually has the effect of raising the value of our superannuation assets.
That's positive. Speaking of the US, there's another question about noting that US Treasury yields have increased a lot over the past month. And some speakers from the Fed have said that it's doing some of the work for the Fed. We've seen yields in Australia go up as well. How does the RBA think about that?
Yeah, well, it's obviously something that we, along with financial markets, are watching extremely closely, along other central banks as well. And I think the way to think about the rise in yield, you can kind of decompose long-term yields into, you know, two elements, as most people in this room will know. It's kind of, you can look at the real yield and then there's expected inflation. Now, inflation expectations are still pretty well anchored in advanced economies, around, you know, not too far from targets, between 2 and 3%. And most of the rise has really been in real yields. And look, that reflects a range of factors. But more recently, there's a few different things at play. Most of them, you know, perhaps some of them, when I am talking very recently, do reflect term premium, whereas earlier it was, you know, central bank raising policy rates and policy rate expectations. So term premium has risen a bit, and that reflects, you know, uncertainty about the outlook for inflation, uncertainty about the outlook for growth. And, you know, in the US in particular, where yields have been particularly volatile, it may also reflect, you know, increased issuance given a different fiscal position. And also the Fed's letting their portfolio of bonds kind of roll off as they do kind of passive QT. Mm-hmm. Some of these factors are at play in Australia, but one thing that isn't is the general debt and deficits issue that, you know, kind of at work in the US. The other thing I'd say is that the long end of the yield curve matters a bit less in Australia. It's not that it doesn't matter at all, it just matters a bit less, and most of the funding here is at the shorter end of the curve. So these sorts of moves have kind of less of an implication for us than maybe they do for the Fed, where kind of long-term rates matter a bit more.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, we're getting a ton of questions through the app. Thank you all. Maybe we have time for one or two more. You mentioned in your speech, Penny, that Australian banks account for a large proportion of Australia's liabilities.
Yeah.
But how exactly is it hedged so that they aren't left with exchange rate risk?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So it's a good question. And it's actually an important one because it also it goes to the heart of this question about why, you know, our foreign liability position is sustainable. So about 90% of banks' long-term assets are hedged with derivatives. And that's FX swaps and cross-currency basis swaps. And most of these instruments are maturity matched to the underlying debt. So they don't only protect against kind of FX risk, but also kind of rollover risk. So there's that extra layer of protection for banks built in there.
Very good. Well, I think we have time actually for one more. Looks like the highest rated question is, we have been used to higher local cash rates over the last 40 years in Australia relative to the US and Europe to attract capital and maintain the capital current account balance. Should we consider the change in the current account will reverse this? Thank you, Michael.
There's really only one country in the world, maybe there's more, but the main one is the United States, where the returns on their assets are higher than the returns on their liabilities, and this has been called the US's exorbitant privilege in a way, because they're a reserve currency, and I don't think that is really going to change, to be honest. Australia is definitely an internationalized you know, we definitely have an internationalized currency, and that gives us some advantages. And in some ways, we're a little bit like the US because we have a net foreign equity position these days. But I don't think that relationship with kind of rates in the US is going to change anytime soon.
Thank you so much. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. Please, the audience, join me in thanking Penny. Penny, thank you so much.
Thank you.